Hello, I'm Mischievous Mark Giannacchio, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, Amazing Fantasy number 15, and of course, all of the Amazing Spider-Man annuals, which I say do not count.
Mark, you've got to always start this show bragging, man. Like, what is that with you?
I don't know. It's almost like that's what the words on the page tell me to do. I would also just naturally do it anyway. Did I tell you I got an Amazing Fantasy 15, Dan? I think I told you that, but I'm going to tell you again. Anyway, who are you?
Well, in the spirit of your braggadocio, I will introduce myself. I'm Dapper Dan Gavassin, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, including the annuals, which I say count. That's not a brag. That's just like a humble idea about like the valuation of my comics and how every comic truly should be allowed to be special and count. But I will admit, for me, Amazing Fantasy 15 remains a fantasy, and yeah, it can count too.
Oh, well, I appreciate that, Dan. Well, anyway, welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic universe. And thanks for joining us for this review episode of the Amazing Spider Talk.
Yeah, if you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, and future, subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review to help spread the word about our show. They really do help us.
Man, I don't feel like I've said that line before, Dan, since like the Available Alan days when we were kind of reversing roles. I just wanted to say that. Like, I was almost out of practice with it. Anyway, this podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and of course, keep this podcast going, go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon.
Yeah, today on the show, Mark and I are going to be discussing Amazing Spider-Man Volume 6, number 43. This issue was written by Zeb Wells. The absolutely stunning cover, at least I think so, and interior artwork is by John Romita Jr., inks by Scott Hanna, colors by Marcio Menez, and of course, letters by VC's Joe Caramagna. This issue was first released on February 14th, 2024, and Mark, it's been like almost a solid month since the last issue of Amazing Spider-Man. It feels like forever since we've done this. Why don't you get us into the recap of issue 43?
It's been a month, but I'm sure we'll have like 900 issues in succession just to make up for lost time. Anyway.
Absolutely.
We open in Harlem Hospital, and Peter is making good of his random aside from last issue that Randy Robertson was nearly fatally shot some time ago, setting off the gang war. Remember that? He suggested that he should probably visit him and reminds readers that this entire arc is about doing right by Randy. So he's finally doing exactly that and nothing more. Thanks for the check-in, Spidey. Robbie tells Spidey to get her done, and Spidey rendezvous with his squad, who he really hasn't hung out much with since this all started, and Tombstone's there too, of course. And then they go off to end a gang war. We're back in Central Park, where a bunch of villains are staring each other down in broad daylight, and just when you thought the stereotype of New York City that's on Fox News every night couldn't be more true, here you go. Madame Mask is telling Beetle and the Syndicate that if they give up their territory, she'll make them rich. But Janice says that they're a startup gang of villains and don't have much of overhead. And I'm thinking, but wouldn't an infusion of capital at this stage be welcomed? I digress. So Mask shouts out, Malakatai! Did I get it right, Dan? I don't know. But maybe I gotta do it with the fingers. Malakatai! And it sounds like a game about a gorilla and a jump man. Digger gets after it while Shotgun starts firing away. Janice and Madame Mask stare each other down, and then Mask just starts firing all over the place from her magic amulets, and it's not looking pretty. However, Mask is told to look up, and she says, "Oh, drat. No, it's not the Cosmic Cube dropping from the Thanos copter, but She-Hulk and the Spidey Squad." Miles tells Peter to do his thing, and Jessica Drew and Elektra also get their witty banter in while hitting folks. We get a rhyme from Rabble about how she's going to kick Miles' ass for Mask. And then that leads to a showdown between Shotgun and Tombstone. Just before we see them throw hands, we bounce over to Spider-Man and he confronts Madame Mask, who he calls dibs on for setting his city on fire. And I probably would have been more into that if we didn't spend two issues bantering with the Kingpin and Typhoid Mary, only for them to pull out of the story altogether. But I digress again. Spider-Man lets Mask know that he might lose his friend due to her war, and she seems unapologetic about it and starts fighting back. Meanwhile, Rabble and Miles face off, and Rabble makes fun of Miles' sword, and she's clearly speaking for me here. Also, Elektra fights Silvermane, and Jessica Drew fights Count Nefaria. Just about everyone pairs off, like it's a high school party, and I'm left alone holding a red Solo cup and describing how the Hobgoblin isn't actually Ned Leeds. Too real, Zeb. Too real. Then we circle back to a fight with actual stakes, as Tombstone finally gets his revenge on Shotgun, smacking the snot out of him. He hits him so hard, Shotgun forgets why they're fighting because Tombstone broke the sigil that has him brainwashed. Dan, this is giving me Sinister War vibes, where I was the one who forgot why everyone was fighting. Either way, Tombstone speaks for all of us when he says, "You can't blame a magic tattoo on everything that's been happening," but Shotgun assures us that's actually the case. He's been working with the government from before this whole gang war started, and he was doing some recon on the real perceived threat, dun dun dun, Janice Lincoln. Lonnie is in shock. Anyway, so Lonnie punches Shotgun for good, but then goes looking for Janice, who's biding her time and waiting for the scrum to die down. Back to Spidey, and he's still on Mask, who sticks Owl on him. Spidey takes down Owl in one punch, just to remind everyone that he's a chump. So then we get a double-page splash of Mask saying, "Kill Spidey!" But Spider-Man gets the jump on her before the story flashes over to Janice and Lonnie, seemingly having a moment. Tombstone didn't realize what Janice was becoming, and Janice shoots him down by telling him she doesn't care what he thinks anymore. So in typical domineering dad fashion, Tombstone rips off her beetle wings and conks her in the head. He lets her know whoever wins today will have to be a monster to own everything. And that's not going to be her. It's his cross to bear. There you have it, Dan.
Well, a dramatic issue, Mark, and a great retelling of it. I think the last couple issues we've been flagging this kind of like, here we go. It's a Niclo edited Spider-Man event. By that, we mean Spider-Man is not going to be in it very much or not really play a key role in it. I had a feeling that this issue kind of started to correct that problem. I don't think it gets it completely out of the woods, but I definitely felt like, oh boy, like, and just as I kind of figured they might, it would start to try to like mend that bridge back again. What did you think about Spider-Man's inclusion in this issue? And do you think there's still time to pull off what we described when we were talking about First Strike, which is the most gang wars tend to forget Spider-Man or create a confusing mess of a gang war? You kind of can't really like have it all when you do these gang war search, or at least it seems like writers aren't able to do that. Do we think there's still time for Zeb to pull this one out?
I guess the flip side of this versus, say, you know, Dead Languages is, you know, the real fluff where the thread was starting to get lost happened more so in the middle of the storyline versus the end. So you can maybe make a case that there is time for recovery. I mean, we certainly thought Dead Languages was really cooking until all of a sudden it just like dropped like a stone and the focus shifted entirely. There were elements of this where, in a vacuum, I thought they were decent moments, but like it does feel a little like talk is cheap at this point. I mean, it's hard for me to really be totally sold on the stakes when, you know, we really didn't get much in terms of Peter and Randy, and, you know, even just Peter's confrontation with Madame Mask. I mean, we raised the issue episodes ago here, Dan, that, like, Mask is just not a good antagonist for Spider-Man here. I mean, there's really no, like there's nothing personal really going on here. She's just making her moves, and it's really more about her battling the Lincolns for territory, which I guess involves Spider-Man by proxy. You know, when he's like confronting her, like, you know, I'm going to take you down for burning my city. You know, like, I wanted to be like, yeah, but it was just like, yeah, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm just like, I'm not totally with it, because, like, I still feel that, you know, the comic itself, the issues preceding this comic just didn't do the work to get us here. So, you know, what kind of comes across as a nice moment, it's just kind of flatlines there. I'm just not totally, like, gung-ho about this, because I just, like, I'm like, all right, you know, like, we'll see what we can do. But, like, I don't know what emotional punch that Zeb can do in a final chapter, even in a double-sized one, that could really bring this around back to what we got in the opening salvo with First Strike. But, I mean, I guess we'll see. I don't want to totally write it off.
I felt like this was kind of like a, like, penultimate chapter to the comic I kind of wish I was reading, you know, like the lines, like you said, with Madame Mask, where Spider-Man finally, like, faces her down. It's like, I could see a world where that would be a rewarding moment of vengeance, you know, like leveraging Randy's injury. But, like, even that is kind of indirectly tied to Mask. Like, you know, she didn't shoot him herself, and Spider-Man wasn't there. You know, like, and so like that issue, that First Strike issue, was really powerful. But you can see how, like, I don't know why the emphasis was placed so heavily in this book on the kind of twists and turns of, like, you know, Hammerhead's girlfriend and like all of that stuff, you know, instead of just having a direct target that we could really point everything at, you know, and spending time with Spider-Man, we spent time on all of the ins and outs of the gang war. And I think all that stuff was very fun in the moment, but when it doesn't add up to an emotional payoff, which it definitely did not here for me, you know, you see that time was kind of like wasted when it could have been better spent focusing on character, the characters that we're really invested in, which is, say, Spider-Man. And so, like, I love all the stuff that we got in this issue, but it does feel like very late. You know, the return to Randy at the beginning, like, was exactly what I wanted several issues ago. And I get why Spider-Man's doing it here. He's like, the big battle is coming. I want to go back to Randy and declare that I'm going to do it. But it doesn't add anything to the story other than reminding you that that's why we got here in the first place. There's no new wrinkle introduced. It's just like, hey, remember this from First Strike? Like, this is why Spider-Man's involved. And it's like, no, at this point, that should be complicated. It, you know, Randy should be flatlining or something. Like, give me something new that's going to, like, amp up the emotional stakes here. And instead, it's just like, oh, yeah, Spider-Man should be a part of this. And I loved all of his fighting. But again, when you ignore him for several issues, the emotional, like, you know, catharsis is just not really there as nice as it is. I mean, I did cheer when Spider-Man took out the owl in one punch, but, like, you know, that's fine. Like, and again, this is, like, maybe damning with fan praise, but, like, it's all fine. It's all, like, good Spider-Man comics, but it's not, like, paying off an event in, like, that has so much potential. Like, it's all right there. It's sitting right there. Like, do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, in the Amazing Spider Talk, Mark Sayings' drinking game, I'm going to say this is quintessential telling, not showing storytelling here. I mean, it's just, you know, we're being told, like, oh, look, you know, Spider-Man's worried about Randy, and Robbie tells him to go get her done. And now he's confronting Madame Mask, and it's, you ruined my city, and I'm mad. But, like, there's nothing that's been done to show us this journey, really. I mean, it's like, you know, we like, I'm not to beat a dead horse, but I know I mentioned this in the recap, but I mean, let's just like point out the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Those two Kingpin issues were terrible for this storyline. I mean, they completely derailed it. I mean, it just, you know, like they were fun in their, I guess, in their own isolated way, but like it just derailed the whole, like those two issues could have been done showing this journey in a more concrete way. I mean, even the team itself of like heroes, like I know that they all have their own books, but like everything just feels so disconnected and disparate right now. So like, you know, seeing them kind of come back together for the first time, I'm just like, oh, okay. This was no, you know, big battle sequence in Spider Island where, you know, you had Agent Venom and Captain America and Kane and, you know, like it felt like this crescendo of all these things that have been kind of taking apart on separate paths, but still connected paths. Coming in together, it was just basically, you know, well, Miles is fighting Rabble still, and Jessica Drew's pissed off at anything related to the Magia or to Hydra. I don't know. It just didn't really click in an emotionally fervent way. And yeah, like fine storytelling, I think is probably the best way to put it.
Yeah, and I really like the kind of like gang of Spidey friends stuff. Like, I like how they're all paired off well in the battle. Like, there's some elegance to how that's handled, and that like everyone got a little story and got to come back together. Like, I frankly, that worked maybe more for me than I think it did for you. You know, I think those Kingpin issues, like, we need to sell in Spider-Man's investment in this. I mean, imagine, right, we've got this whole arc. And again, this is me pitching a story we didn't get, and I hate doing that, but like, because that's not really how criticism should work. But if, you know, we just got Spider-Man to like recreate all these unions with all of his friends across New York City after he betrayed them and went through this whole ordeal with Mary Jane, and he's healing, and he got infected by Norman's sins, and he's finally ready to start healing. And then this big attack happens on his family and on his city. And we get issues where like all of those friends have to flee. Aunt May is like having to leave her apartment. And, you know, Norman is his like company is being shut down. Like they're just all these people feel so absent from this when we're supposed to be at a point where all of this is coming together. And spend two issues with those people and Spider-Man having to like save his friends and prove himself valuable to the people that he loves, instead of what's going on with Kingpin being a faint. I get this desire to interconnect the Marvel universe, but sometimes I think that like Zeb Wells is like writing a Marvel book instead of a Spider-Man book, you know, like putting Madame Mask as the villain here. Maybe Zeb is very familiar with Madame Mask and he feels like we're all reading about that stuff. You know, some of our ignorance about her magic powers probably shows that we're not, or at least we're not remembering it. Throw us a bone, like give us a Spider-Man thing. You know, we're not checking in on this to read about Marvel necessarily. We're checking in on this to read about Spider-Man.
For sure. Well, you mentioned Mask and her magic powers and... So what did you think about the Mask Beetle confrontation that we got in this issue?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that stuff is really solid. It's superficial, but that's kind of built in for Mask. And just to be clear, we were contacted by one of our listeners, Jason, who reminded me that Mask does use magic now. That was established in Mark Waid's Doctor Strange run. But I'll put out there, I still think there's something unique about the sigils here. Like, I don't ever remember that being a part of her appearances there, and that being a Zeb Wells staple from the Rabin stuff. Like, I do think that that is a unique wrinkle on this character. But either way, I think, like, their fight is actually really interesting. Mask is really in it just for money and power. And for Beetle, there's something much more personal involved, which in some ways makes her scarier. And I think, you know, of any of the stories that have played out across this book during Gang War, that's the one that like is cooking the most and has me the most emotionally invested. Like I can't really ding this issue and this story so hard because there is a story here that I am caught up in. It's just not Spider-Man's story.
What do you think of Beetle's journey here in you know, both in this issue, but over the course of this arc. I mean, because I did admittedly struggle a little bit with it because it's, you know, I know we got some lip service. I don't remember if it was last issue or the issue before where she, you know, we were kind of getting more of her origin and like her feeling, you know, not even neglected by Lonnie, but, you know, terrorized by him and kind of pushed aside. It first felt like, you know, when she was introduced in this storyline, you know, she was taking the territory while Tombstone was indisposed, as almost as like, you know, in, you know, fighting in his name, you know, like I'm going to keep the Lincoln legacy living on. And then, you know, Shotgun kind of comes forward and is like, well, no, you know, this whole time I've been on, you know, your daughter to see, cause you know, we're, you know, and it just, again, it just didn't feel totally earned. Like I didn't get this sense that she, you know, from the beginning was this like power hungry, you know, was more about like, I think kind of defining her legacy in the eyes of this monster of a father, but not necessarily because of just like her own blind ambition per se. And it didn't necessarily feel congruous to me. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? Am I making sense to you?
I think it mostly works on the page more than it does emotionally work for me. You know, I think the real missed opportunity here is to like establish her kind of blind emotionality over this. And I think they've done some of that, right? Like, you know, it's like, hey, like you're not going to be able to hold like Brooklyn while also fighting those other battles. And she's like, it doesn't matter. We're going to go full force. And she's just kind of making decisions rashly. And I think the thing that's missing, that's been missing largely from this story that was so promising in First Strike, is the Randy Robertson of it all. Like she was there and watched her fiance, like intended, you know, like all the way up to the wedding husband, like get shot in front of her. And that moment was supposed to be like radicalization moment for her, where she was like, I'm going to step into this gang war and like take it back from the people that thought that they could take these things from me. But there's been no reflection on Randy from her part. And so like, we just kind of have to trust that she's still operating on that emotionality, and it's complicated by the father thing. So it's not entirely clean, like why she's doing this. And like I can imply that there's like family elements. She was creating her own family and her father's legacy still took that away from her. She was robbed of a father as well, you know, and she's like, well, then I'll just step into that fray. But it is kind of proving to be a little bit thin at this point, even if I still kind of buy it, just kind of on like she's kind of in over her head and now she's just going to keep going rather than admit like that she might be at folly for all of this, is kind of where I imagine her to be at the moment.
Any specific thoughts on Mask? I mean, I thought she had some fun one-liners here. I mean, like, I don't know, like it's still going to take a lot of work to just totally bring me on board with her, but like she has some moments here for sure. Did anything stand out to you in terms of just like her demeanor, her behavior, some of her one-liners or anything like that?
I mean, we're going to talk about John Romita Jr. later, but just the power gauntlets, like the like purple hue is really fun to look at. I mean, like they've made her a visually distinct villain in this, and like that goes a long way, I think, for a supervillain. But I love the bit where she is like on the battlefield and it looks like she's about to win, and then all the heroes show up and she says, quote, the moral fanatics are here, end quote. I thought that was a nice bit of characterization from Wells in regards to like, you know, she's not in this for any kind of moralizing. She's in it for business, and which I think is a nice counter to everybody else whose emotions are kind of like riled up by this whole gang war thing. And she even tries to bribe like one last time, like Beetle to like back off and like, look, you can just be rich. And she just really doesn't get why Beetle is so emotionally caught up in this whole thing. And I thought that was a nice bit of characterization, even if it's kind of a repeat of the way that they interacted in the previous issue.
Okay. Well, anything else on the two of them, or do we want to take our first little break here?
Yeah, let's take a break, Mark.
All right. Well, what are we promoting today, Dan?
Yeah, well, today we're going to talk about our Amazing Spider Substack, which is amazingspider.substack.com. It's our regular newsletter that's completely free that Mark and I write all of our thoughts about Spider-Man that we're not putting in this podcast, which, heaven forbid, you could ever imagine we have thoughts about Spider-Man that we're not covering here. Mark, we just put out one, maybe our most popular Substack yet. What kind of things did we talk about in that?
Well, I feel like every edition becomes our most popular one yet. But we talked, we had a great conversation about the state of Mary Jane Watson vis-a-vis Jackpot number one. We also had some great little history tidbits in there and some comic book remembrances, including the one of Amazing Spider-Man number 59, aka the first MJ cover. Just some great stuff in there and some stuff that you really won't hear about on this podcast ever. Well, you'll hear it in bits and pieces, but not so such concentrated, illuminated writing, I guess you would say.
I was proud of us talking about Mary Jane without getting a bunch of people upset. You know, it seemed like people were fairly open to our opinions on the character, which, you know, in some places is maybe not true, but you know, I think we had a pretty reasonable discussion about how we feel about Mary Jane right now, which is to say, I don't think we're really digging it. You can find out more of our thoughts on the characterization of Mary Jane by going to amazingspider.substack.com. Now, one more thing that I wanted to address on here is that we, on Patreon, we're doing a raffle. We have an extra copy of Ultimate Spider-Man number one, the variant black suit cover, which like I think is going for like $70 on eBay. We thought, well, hey, if we got an extra one of these, why not raffle it off to some of our patrons and announce on the podcast who we're going to be sending it to? So we assigned a bunch of random numbers to people based on their, you know, Patreon donations. We're going to do a raffle right here. So, you know, Rick, give us a spin of the old machine. The winner is Michael Krauschar. So, Michael, if you're listening to this, just contact us on Patreon and we will get that comic sent on over to you. Congratulations. And thank you for supporting us on the Patreon.
You can send your kids to college on that comic, Dan. I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of sending your kids to college, the Lincolns. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I thought we were talking about some John Romita, who's, you know.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's talk about John Romita, who went to college on his father's Spider-Man dough, maybe.
There we go. Oof. You know, I have to say, like, I haven't been totally floored by Romita in this arc since it started. I mean, I know he certainly loved being able to draw Typhoid Mary again and... Who knows? I mean, I know you were talking about synergy with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Maybe that was all just those two issues was for. It was giving Jazzy Jr. John an opportunity to draw Typhoid Mary. But I don't know. I feel like JRJR showed up to play on this issue here. I mean, like we had like lots of big landscapes. I mean, like I'm still not totally sold even from a visual standpoint on like just a bunch of like villains and costumes in Central Park in broad daylight. But like, that's more of a writing issue. He did a great job with it. but I mean, what are your thoughts on Romita in this issue here?
I just feel reading this in comparison to all of the other books that we've been getting in this Gang War line where everybody gets to draw these big battle events, which like, hats off to all the artists. Like, it's not easy to draw this many people on screen and have it be coherent. But, like, I think an issue like this really helps to highlight Romita Jr.'s storytelling strengths. I mean, you've got dozens of people packed into these panels, and I feel like it's coherent the whole way through. I mean, yeah, there's probably some figures that you could like point at. You know, I think he's not super comfortable drawing Miles and his, you know, blades and things like that. And, you know, some of the stuff can be a little bit distorted, but the visual flow and like how the battle is established through each panel, I think is always easy to read. Everything is very clearly presented spatially. It makes sense on who's on whose side and how the battle is going. I'm always in awe of like how much he thought he puts into like how coherent it is. And this is not to bash Humberto Ramos. You just put out this great Instagram post about like his big splash pages. But I think like Ramos goes for like he maximizes as much as he can put on the page. And Romita does the same, but it never feels quite as crowded or difficult to like ferret out what the subject is that sometimes Ramos's stuff does. Like I always know exactly where to look on the page for Romita. It's just so clean. And I think that's really what that like deadline style can allow for, is just like, there's no superfluous detail. It's all there just for you to read as a story. And I don't know. I'm repeating the hits of what we say about his work, but I think an issue like this can really help to highlight that.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I made a crack about the Central Park and Broad Daylight thing, but the fact of the matter is, like, I feel like Romita is the kind of artist that can capture a melee in Central Park in Broad Daylight, whereas a Ramos or some, it's more about like just the chaotic, almost like beyond what's imaginable, you know, like it goes beyond the mind's eye. And I mean, I love both for different reasons, but like, you know, as you were describing it in that fashion, I'm like, well, you know, actually, if you're going to have one Marvel superstar artist draw a melee in Central Park and like at 2 p.m, it should be Romita. Cause he'll space it out and he'll put everyone exactly where they need to be, because like, you know, you should be seeing everyone pretty well established in broad daylight in the middle of in like the grand lawn of Central Park. You know, like it makes sense. It works anyway.
I could read him drawing She-Hulk beating up AIM goons like all day long. I mean, just the crunch of their bodies. You know, these ambiguous beekeepers. You know, I super dug all of that. And you know, I talked about the geography of it, but like, you know, even things like just the way he has people facing in the panel to like have them facing towards each other. I mean, it's simple things like that that like make it really easy to read and never have me questioning who's on what side. I mean, there's dozens of like super people here. And yeah, we've been reading about them across a variety of books. And so it shouldn't be confusing who's on what side, but like, it's so easy to read this page. Any highlights for you from the battle sequences we got?
I mean, we talked about a few of them. I mean, obviously the double page splash, or well, it's not, I guess it's not a full double page splash, because you had like a kind of a little bit of a grid on the left side, but like of like Spidey just kind of jumping up and going after Mass there, I thought was really well done. I mean, just the whole sequence with the owl and you know, like Owl kind of showing up and just getting, you know, one punched like he's Green Lantern to Batman, which worked. This comic sometimes suffers from, you know, that you know, especially in issues like this, kind of like that obligatory check-in syndrome. I do feel like Romita's art does it well, like because he paces the panel so well, so we can go like, oh, and now here's Daredevil, and now here's She-Hulk, and now here's Miles, and now here's back to Spider-Man, and now here's Tombstone and Janice, and here's Tombstone and Shotgun, and like we're moving and he just kind of it's very precise and well tempoed. There's a cadence to how we kind of go from panel to page with him. This was just a really good case study in you know, this kind of generation of Romita and how he's pulling it off still, basically. So what about for you? Anything that really like stood out for you?
You said it. I do want to talk about that, like that splash page, to piggyback on what you were just talking about. you know, it's the pacing of it, and it's all about these like wide images that then narrow in on these like little dramas within the battle. And that's, you know, a good coordination between Wells and Romita, but Romita is the one that still makes you like not forget that the battle is happening. Like his backgrounds are beautifully layered, and he uses the size of the panels with these intense close-ups to really zero in. Like the whole time that like Tombstone and Shotgun are having that kind of like intimate back and forth with this reveal that we're going to talk about in a moment, I'm never forgetting that there's other stuff going on in the battle, but the size of the paneling really communicates to me that this is an intimate moment that's, you know, happening inside of this larger thing. And it's that consistency of how he uses the images to create this language that makes it so strong. And then I'll add that, like, Marcio Menéndez, I love some of the stuff he does with the color here. Like, he uses white lines to make characters pop out of the background as if they're being hit from behind by like a hair or rim light. And it highlights important figures at any moment during the battle. And it really helps you read the page and know where you're supposed to be looking. And I thought that was stunning stuff. But again, it's that splash that like is my favorite image from the issue of Spider-Man and Madame Mask, like really foregrounded in the air. The big like twirling spin of her like uppercut with the magic gauntlet that like almost tears the page. Like it's not literally doing it, but it feels like it's interacting with the physicality of the comic in the way that like those early Vulture issues of this run did, where you had to turn the page to read it. This felt like if they could have literally torn that page in the comic, they would have. And then that image itself too, like, there's little stories going on in the background of that, of all the villains at different, you know, depths into the image that are having their own little skirmishes. It's your quintessential, like, great Marvel team battle, you know, like, I just thought that was a stunning, I think everybody that turned that page probably was like, wow, you know, Romita showed up for this image. Tip of my hat to him there.
Awesome. All right, let's talk a little bit. Let's end this review talking a little bit about Tombstone and Janice here. I mean, obviously, you know, like there has never been a more well-dressed villain slash anti-hero. I mean, you know, it's Tombstone has been a very interesting arc in this storyline, and I'm still trying to decide where I am on it. You know, obviously he gets kind of this shocking revelation from Shotgun promptly before he punches him out for good measure, which I did enjoy, which is that, you know, it's basically he learns that Janice is really kind of over the deep end here in terms of her ambition for power here. You know, obviously we still have one more issue left, but like, you know, and I guess this is where I'm kind of like a little bit of a mixed bag with, is, you know, like the conclusion of it is, well, I can't let you have that, so I have to be the bad guy and be the monster yet again. And I guess that's part of it. It's like there's a part of me that's like, can Lonnie go back to being the monster after the storyline? Because I don't really think he can. Like, I mean, like, I know we've talked about, like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, this is bad for my image hanging out with you, Spider-Man. But, like, he really is, like, part of the crew now. And you know, I don't suspect that he's going to be, you know, a hero. But, like, I don't know. Like,
alive.
Yeah. Well, or that, you know, that's the other part of it, of course. But I don't know. I guess, like, It was surprising to me that he's just like kind of like ending this issue being like, and I'm back to being the bad guy. I'm like, I you know, no, I don't buy that. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Lonnie here?
I think emotionally it connected for me, but logically there was a disconnect, which is kind of the opposite of what I was saying about the rest of the issue, which is, you know, I think that this is a really nice thematic like tie back into the very beginning of this run with World Without Love and the idea of like, I'm two different people and I'm keeping you safe. And it's a lot of the themes we've been circling around this whole, you know, gang war story that again, does this nice tie back to where all of this started. But logically, I don't really understand the timeline of this, or like why this moment with Shotgun was what kind of tipped him over. Because Shotgun says like the government had him watching Janice Lincoln, which I guess I get, like, you know, as a member of, you know, the syndicate, you know, she's certainly not been out of trouble, you know, but the idea of like foregrounding her over Tombstone prior to gang war doesn't really make sense, especially now that we know that like Shotgun's been, I mean, we've known it for a little bit, the Shotgun's been under the control of Madame Mask, but for Tombstone, I don't know what that means. Like, okay, the government was watching her instead of me, so maybe she's getting in deeper trouble, but like Shotgun tried to kill Tombstone, but he wasn't doing that on behalf of the government. He was doing that on behalf of Madame Mask. So like the kind of mortal peril that Janice finds herself in, I guess you could say if Madame Mask retains power, she will eternally come after Janice. But then why include the whole government angle into this? It just seems kind of like logically convoluted to me, and timeline-wise convoluted. Like, but it still worked emotionally for me. Like, I understood the whole like the father taking on the sins of the daughter and ripping off her wings, which is a kind of nice like you know, literal like metaphor, you know, like, yeah, I'm clipping your wings.
Not terribly
so you
subtle,
can't fly.
Subtle. Yeah. It's
yeah. But like, these are superhero comics. I'm cool with them not being subtle.
Yeah. Oh,
you
for
know?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like, I think all that stuff really works. And that final page is like really nicely delivered. I just don't feel like it's as big of a turn as something like this should be. Like, one, I think we were all kind of expecting it would go this way. And then two, I'm like, wouldn't it be better if Janice did something unforgivable and Tombstone saw it and was like, oh my God, what have I created? Like, I need to stop this. You know, there is something sinister to her, like standing back and watching everybody else get hurt for her own gain. And she's like, I'm just waiting for the moment for me to sneak in and take down Mask after everybody else has done the work. Like, that's kind of devious, but it's not enough that I feel like Tombstone would be like, what a monster. Cause that's exactly the play that like Tombstone was kind of going with as a part of the hero team, which is like, if we can use Kingpin and all this stuff to like give us the one up and let everybody else fight the battles that we can't fight. That was literally his plan 2 issues ago. Like, I'm like, what about this would change Lonnie's mind? Like, I didn't see that, even if I'm like, I'm on the ride for this arc.
Yeah. You know, I just feel like we're kind of a far cry in an emotional sense of like, you know, watching him try and tear Wilson Fisk limb from limb here. You know what I mean? Like the fire is missing here. And yeah, I think you made a great point too, in terms of, you know, like his reaction to Janice. I mean, yeah, Janice is kind of, I don't even know if she's being like that unforgivable here. She's just kind of being a weasel, if anything, in terms of like, I'm just lying in wait here. I think I wanted a little more from that, you know, not to, you know me, I'm out of the prediction business, but you did allude to it a few minutes ago. So, I mean, I'm assuming you're of the mindset that Lonnie doesn't have much real estate left in the world of Spider-Man comics here, because like that's the other thing. Like I'm just, there's just a part of me that's just like, I don't see how he goes back after this storyline, and I don't know if he's not dead. I don't know what the you know, desirability of like a tweener anti-hero Tombstone is in the world of Spider-Man comics. Do you have thoughts on either of those scenarios?
I don't think that if he survives, he's an anti-hero. I think he's going full bad. If that's where we're going with this, like if he survives or whatever he does, I think he's going to do something like that truly puts an end to this, that's unforgivable in some way. Like if I had to guess, I mean, I think Zeb is, you know, probably got a few surprises up his sleeve about how this all ends and to what extent Lonnie is willing to go for his daughter. I mean, like the themes of Spider-Man tell us like failed father figures or dead father figures, you know, are like, you know, in our playbook. And I think that that is like likely to come true in the next issue. I don't think we're going to get a Punisher-esque good slash bad Lonnie. I think whatever decision he made at the end of this issue is like one way or the other, like a full throated, no turning back point for him. But maybe there is a way that Lonnie could get out of this with a soul intact and save his daughter. But like in a book like Spider-Man, I feel like you don't get to have like a half commitment, you know?
No, for sure. Well, I'll be curious to see certainly how they resolve his story here, because it's probably the one I'm most invested in at this point based on the arc of the story. Do you want to give this thing a grade, Dan?
Yeah, I think this is like a C plus B minus.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like waffling between the two. I'll say B minus just to give.
Yeah, B minus. Let's go with it.
Why don't we take it on home, Dan? It is, of course, that time for all good things to come to an end. So we want to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning into this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk. Dad, just before we get into the total goodbyes, I want to plug, I will be appearing, or I have appeared, on another podcast called The Runs. I know, and it's a great podcast name, The Runs. It is by comic book artist Ryan Tanner Alexander, and I am on his show talking about the J. Michael Straczynski, John Romita Jr. run on Amazing Spider-Man back in the early 2000s. It's called The Runs because it's about famous runs in comics. It's not about diarrhea, but it's a really cool conversation where actually I am in the pro camp of this run, and the host is actually not a fan of this run, but we don't yell, we don't get angry at each other. I just, you know, go download it on Apple Podcasts and check it out. Look up The Runs or Ryan Tanner Alexander, and you'll find it.
Yeah, I've already got it downloaded, so you could say I have The Runs. we'll leave that alone.
I didn't name it, okay?
Well, anyway, this podcast exists because of listener support on Patreon. I'm going to go buy some medicine for while I listen to that run. For only $3.99 a month, you can help support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews the same week the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. So thank you to everyone who already supports us and the work that we do.
Yeah, Dan and I really want to increase all the awesome work we do in 2024. So if you are already a patron or just want to become one, please help us to meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and click on the big old Patreon button to get started.
This podcast was edited by Rick Coast. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galecki. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friend, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge. And our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. Don't forget to subscribe to our Amazing Spider Talk Substack. We'll be covering all of Gang War as it concludes in our Substack and all the other topics we weren't able to talk about today. So if you want to keep up with our thoughts on everything Spider-Man, that's the place to go, amazingspider.substack.com. So Mark, until you tear off my podcasting wings and take on the full burden of this podcast yourself, what's our motto?
With great podcasts, there must also come The Amazing Spider Talk.
Don't miss the next installment.
And in another dimension with great podcasts, there must also come The Runs.